Welcome to the China Desk Podcast, presented by the Federal Newswire, with your host, Steve Yates.
Welcome to the China Desk Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Yates, Senior Research Fellow for China and National Security at the Heritage Foundation. A reminder to our audience, for whom we are most grateful, viewers can watch the China Desk on YouTube or subscribe to hear all our interviews on Apple, Spotify, and most other podcast providers. We welcome you to check out our website and show archive at chinadeskpodcast.com. My guest today is Kaiyu Jin, global economist and author of The New China Playbook, Beyond Capitalism and Socialism. She served as a tenure professor of economics at the London School of Economics and Political Science from 2009 to 2024. She is currently an affiliate of Harvard University and the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, where she chairs the Institute for Geoeconomics. Her latest book was named one of the best books of 2023 by the Financial Times and Fortune magazine. And with that, Kaiyu, welcome to the China Desk. Let's jump in.
Great to be with you, Steve. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's a pleasure. I warned you at the pre-tape that we like to allow our audience to get to know the people behind the books and the news and the jobs that they have. And we'd love to learn a little bit about what some of the formative things were that fill in the gap from being born in an interesting time and place to now being at a prestigious university writing a book that people around the world should read. So when you were growing up, did you think, you know what, I'm going to really go hardcore into economics and maybe go to that wild country known as the UK?
Well, first of all, I think economics came very, very late in my education career. But I know that starting from high school, the minute I arrived in the U.S., I hoped someday that I would serve as a bridge of some sort between the East and the West, and in particular between U.S. and China. So I think one of the most defining features of my past is really this bicultural background, and now multicultural background, given that I have lived in the U.K. for the last 15 years and have gotten to know Europe very well. But I'm really a true beneficiary of both systems, and I see advantages and disadvantages of both, and including in the education system. But when I was young, growing up in China, because there was so much scarcity of things, and I know that people were very excited about the future in the 1980s when I was born, China was already doing a number of reforms. I did tell my father that I wanted to be a development economist, not knowing what that actually really meant. Probably heard it on TV somehow, because development was really the most important thing. But since then, I think I have at least served somewhat of a role, being somewhat of a bridge between the East and West and U.S. and China at a moment when it is most needed.
Excellent. Well, what did your dad do for a living?
My father worked at the Ministry of Finance in China, and he was one of the first to be sent to the World Bank after the resumption of relationship between U.S. and China. And as he, like many others in his generation who went to the U.S., again, there was huge amount of admiration and being impressed by the United States and what it really offered. And so China at that time was really a very eager learner.
Ah, well, it could be those IMF World Bank gatherings that occur where you might have heard someone talking about what a development economist was, but who knows? Well, what was the arc for coming out of high school? Where did you graduate, and then how did you pick where you were going to go to college?
Well, I didn't pick where I was going to go to high school in the U.S. Basically, it picked me. The visionary headmaster of that time wanted to bring a Chinese student into an American high school. That was back in 1997. And little did I know, I went from being a Communist Party youth league to being straight landed in an American family who was running for state attorney general in New York. And I was supporting Democratic campaigns at that time for the family. It was quite a big contrast. And I was really surprised after talking to so many of these very sophisticated Americans, their impression about China was very different from what I knew about the country that I came from. And so that theme actually persisted. But just as an example to illustrate why it's a cultural phenomenon for China doing what it is, I arrived in American high school and said, look, I want to be number one and I want to go to Harvard. And I don't think anybody wanted to be my friend at that time. But the truth is, in China, that's what everybody wanted to be do, to be number one, or at least a good number of students, they wanted to strive to be the best, and they would actually make it very public. And so when I think about, you know, the pronouncements that China is making, these ambitious goals, not just the country as a whole, but the universities, the companies, everybody wanting to be the best, it is really part of our culture. And whether they achieve it or not is a different issue, but that goal and that dream is still, you know, it resonates with every one of us.
Well, there's a lot of debate in American society today about the pros and cons of Ivy League versus state universities, and sort of the structure of economics and the workplace are very, very different in this decade than they were in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. But it sure seemed to work pretty well for you, because I think a lot of people that you grew up with and went to high school and graduated high school with probably would have liked to gone to Harvard and bounced then over to the London School of Economics. Mm-hmm. But talk a little bit about how you ended up over at LSE.
When I graduated, it was 2009. That was at the height of the Great Recession, financial crisis. So many of the universities in the U.S. were freezing hiring that year. And European universities, having not had the same burden, really took that opportunity to get a group of us from Harvard and MIT graduates to go to Europe. And I arrived at London School of Economics with one of the best departments, certainly the best department of economics in the region, and one of the best in the world. And I've been very blessed to be with within an institution that is also very American at the same time in terms of research standards, but really a very broad department of many different disciplines. But London became my absolute favorite because it really is a truly global center, and it fuses academia, politics, and business.
Well, let's skip ahead a little bit, and now let's talk about how you began the project of working on the book that is the central feature of today's conversation. When did the sort of the idea click and you began the process to prepare for this book? My understanding is, never having been a distinguished author, that these things are not quick projects. They take a lot of writing, rewriting, research, review, and all of that fun stuff. What's a little bit about the timeline and the construction that built what became your book?
I mean, you know, the starting point when I graduated, 2009, China was rising, but it wasn't quite as dominant and prominent as it is now. And many people in the West still had, you know, they were interested in China, but they didn't give it as much importance as obviously they did a few years later. But what I saw also was a need to fill a big gap. And that gap is increasingly wider, wider, but also really critical to fill it in these days, because the misunderstanding of China runs deep. Not that it's an easy country to understand in the first place. Even Chinese citizens don't understand it fully for obvious reasons. But also that I found that the one lens that we look at China, and indeed other countries as well, let's call it Western lens, call it American lens, whatever you will, was quite a narrow one. I don't think it reflected the reality, whether it's about the Chinese economic opportunities or the fallacies. I don't think the criticisms were actually in the right spots. So I felt that given that there has been so much research, especially on the Chinese economy by young scholars, older scholars, really deep knowledge about how this very complex economy works, I felt that it was time to combine all this knowledge and also put in my own personal insights to give a different perspective about the Chinese economy, maybe one from the inside, maybe one filled with examples, and maybe also critiques of its model in a more balanced way, in a more neutral way. And that began... quite a few years ago, but as you're right, the first book especially, it took a few years to really gather my strength. COVID solved everything.
So you had a little extra time to work remotely and crank ahead on writing and editing?
Yes, exactly.
Well, you've already teased us up to a couple of the thresholds that I was hoping to cover about the book. I mean, you have a provocative and informative title, but the window into it is your ultimate thesis that there are some critical misconceptions that are out there about China's economic system. So why don't you give us kind of the wave tops of what the top two or three misconceptions are, and, you know, the how to think explanations for your approach to trying to remedy those gaps.
Mm. Well, the first is that most people think that China's an extremely centralized system, which it is, but the more accurate way to describe it is an extreme form of political concentration, but an equally extreme form of economic decentralization. Going back 30 years, all of the major reforms were implemented by the local governments to all the way to today. The EVs that we're seeing, the mini Silicon Valleys all over China, the solar panels, the new technology, emerging strategic technologies, the local governments really had a hand in that, whether it was building, helping them build and coordinate supply chains to helping them attract talent, really being a one-stop shop that helped many of these companies overcome these barriers. Local governments were really crucial. So this is why in the book, I have a chapter called The Mayor Economy, which I think, you know, very few people really understood deeply how it worked, why it worked, why were the local governments really incentivized to do that, right? As we're speaking, I'm talking to quite a few local governments, and they're helping even clean up the mess in the economy, and negotiate between lenders and creditors. They really do so much, and they do so much for the private companies. That leads to the second misconception, which is somehow the state suppresses the private is an ongoing theme, you know, whether it's the companies or the people. And I like to come back to that. But it's really quite the opposite. I mean, sure, you have instances and anecdotes everywhere of unfair ways. But by and large, the local governments are very incentivized to help out productive companies. Why? Because they earn them quite a bit of, they provide benefits for the local governments in the sense they bring in investment, they create jobs. If you are a national champion, that makes the governments look very good. To give you an example, a semiconductor company recently, you know, did some breakthroughs, and the Beijing government gave them substantial support, and they said, "Look, we want a Beijing champion." They didn't say, "We want a Chinese champion coming out of this. We want a Beijing champion." So that's an example where you see all these local governments almost bending their back forward to help these private companies. And again, this is not just one or two, Beijing, Shanghai. It's really everywhere. Some of the major technology companies come from cities you probably, your audience probably have never heard of. Hefei, for instance, has come up with the best quantum companies, and the EV company is NIO, and their headquarters is there. So that there is a big drive to help the private companies, which is a deep misunderstanding as well. And lastly, I'd say that, again, I really want to focus on the theme between the people and the state, because I think this is, there are many other misunderstandings, but this really runs deep. Part of the reason writing this book is that, you know, basically in macroeconomics at Harvard, you're taught three models in macroeconomics, right? Very limited role for the state. State intervention only comes in when there are market failures. Well, you know, I think we need to revise some of the models. There's not only just one model that works, and especially in the beginning, whether it's the beginning stages of development or when you're starting a new industry. Think about the emerging industries, EVs, batteries, solar, you know, these new industries. The big state push is important. And I think the recent years have demonstrated how really important it could be and how critical and pivotal it could be. For instance, EVs. It helps that the Chinese government has rolled out 4 million EV charging stations within a very short period of time. It helps that 80 cities were actually building EVs. That leads to other sorts of problems, but you see that initial push of mobilization, of state coordination is quite important, but we tended to have continuously dismissed that. So the state and the people, also the same thing, right? It's not just authoritarianism if we're looking from the purely Western lens, but there is kind of an implicit contract between the people and authority, between people and their parents, children, their parents, children and teachers, the same level of respect, not blind submission, but an exchange, you know, for stability, for prosperity. Citizens should behave a certain way, but they really demand and expect governments to do some things, and they hold them accountable. And in fact, the Chinese government has been quite responsive, arguably more responsive than many, many other governments in handling major crises or undertaking serious responsibilities.
Well, I think it's important for the audience to understand this clearly, especially from a Chinese point of view, that there are people inside China that are seeing and experiencing life from a different lens than what Americans and our friends and allies around the world may be experiencing.
Could I just add one more, yeah, a more broader point beyond economics? And it's really about Chinese people, right? And everyday life. And I think there's a big misunderstanding there. Unless you go to China, you might read from the newspapers and assume that Chinese people are utterly miserable, or they should be frustrated with the government. And COVID's a different matter, but up until very recently, the vast majority of time, you know, people are very excited about the future. They are quite optimistic. Expectations are rosy. Again, I think there has been some downward pressure recently, which I'm sure we'll get to. But they actually think that the government did a pretty good job in making their lives better. And we're talking about the hundreds of millions, a billion people. And the vast majority believe that just because of the enormous progress they've seen within a human lifetime, or even in my generation, within, you know, a third of your lifetime, that the vast transformation that have actually affected everybody's daily lives, they are grateful. They are grateful when they see chaos and instability and wars outside. They for the peace that we have in China, and they're grateful to see, especially with the disruptions and the very incomprehensible, let's put it that way, strategies of other countries. They are actually in relative terms quite content about their lives.
Yeah, well, it's an important point of view for us to understand. One part of that. That a lot of people from outside of China and those from the United States would have a question about, it would kind of go back to your father's experience in those formative years when the IMF, World Bank, there was a lot of multilateral lending that went into China that was absolutely vital to China's initial stages of development. There was an absolute tsunami of foreign direct investment and manufacturing that came from the outside into China. And so from an outsider's point of view, there was an awful lot to the narrative of China's economic rise that was not actually Chinese. And then there was a part of that that for sure there was government policy that was permissive and compatible with that. And one can't deny the statistical results. But from a Chinese cultural and sort of popular point of view, how much of these inputs from the outside world and even from what now are some of China's maybe competitors is sort of internalized and understood that, yes, there were things that were done by the government that opened up reform and development, but there was also a lot that came from the outside world that fueled that?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. China itself, and especially the government, I'm not sure about the ordinary Chinese citizens clearly understand that globalization is really one of the most fundamental drivers of China's prosperity. And globalization includes trade, admitting China into the WTO, includes foreign investment, FDI, includes foreign technology, know-how, managerial know-how, and all of that collaboration, which is why China does not want to decouple with the U.S. But that said, we look around the world, that is an open opportunity for virtually all of the countries, right? When you talk about global capital flows from the core to the periphery, that is the idea. The idea is to put capital into fast emerging economies with a higher marginal product of capital so that they can earn higher returns. This is not a purely altruistic motive. This is the laws of capital flows and finance. And indeed, a lot of this capital went into developing countries, emerging markets in Argentina and, you know, Latin American countries, et cetera, actually everywhere. But how many countries were able to use it as productively and use that and leverage that to really reach where China is today? Well, a few countries, you know, the likes of Korea and Singapore and Japan earlier on, a few countries that we know have gone to a rich income status. But the vast majority have been stuck in a middle income trap. China's still middle income, but it does cutting edge technology. I'd argue that that is a very unique feature of the Chinese economy today. A developing country with only a quarter of standards of living of the West is able to do cutting edge technology. And I think it has to be a combination of the interaction with the West through capital flows, through the knowledge links, through the universities. And you can say, my argument would be, is that it was accelerated by a big state push. And again, I'm not trying to say that the state push will always be important, but in certain stages, under certain conditions, that is actually what is often the missing link in many countries, including arguably in Europe and in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get to the other part of your book title that I think will capture people's attention. It's the notion of going beyond socialism and capitalism. People will have heard of these things. They might, in some ways, have had conversations that are a hybrid, but in most people's lives, they would think of an either or. And if they thought of the United States of America or the United Kingdom, and they thought about the People's Republic of China, they would think, well, you know, China is run by a communist party, and there is very open talk about socialist economic policies and other policies. And so how do we understand this conversation about getting beyond, in your provocative statement there, getting beyond both of these, and that China is seeming to go in somewhat of a different place? So without my putting words into your mouth, I do want to kind of nudge into how do you address these categories, and where's the landing place if it's beyond capitalism and socialism?
Well, first of all, I think these labels are less and less useful these days. If we look at Europe, right? If we look at Latin America, but also the spectrum that ranges, your position, your preferences as a country between socialist ideals and then capitalistic instincts and market mechanisms and so forth. I think it's less of the time when we were really seriously debating about a black cat or a white cat, as Deng Xiaoping put it back then. But beyond socialism and capitalism, I think that China has fostered a unique model, a combination of, coming back to our previous theme, a unique balance of state coordination and market mechanisms, and a balance between communalism and individualism. And actually, indeed, many of the questions that we ask in the most extreme capitalist countries like the United States and in certain parts of, and indeed in Europe, the most advanced economies, are some of these critical questions that goes beyond what capitalist societies can offer. For instance, the big inequality issues, right? What is economically efficient may no longer be socially optimal. In fact, I'd argue that with increasing economic fragmentation, geopolitical considerations, the rise of geoeconomics, that we're really moving beyond just economic efficiency to talking about resilience, talking about national security, the economic nationalism that is arising is also a response to some of the problems, the challenges that we have encountered in this more freewheeling capitalist societies. And indeed, even if we look at a purely economic perspective, in the last few years, there have been grand revisions of the old, you know, pure capitalist society kind of principles of open up everything, open up your capital flows, open up trade, your financial networks. We've moved beyond that. And so the role of the state has come back. We have talked about discussions about, you know, losing our sense of identity, right, in the age of globalization, in the age of party politics, searching for belonging to community. I think, again, you know, all of these themes are arising precisely because I don't think either a socialist or a capitalist society in its pure and traditional form can answer to these questions. I think one of the most, the distinguishing feature between socialism and capitalism, or at least let me say the distinctive differences in outcome, is dynamic entrepreneurship. So it was argued that you don't see that in socialist countries, you see that in capitalist economies. Well, China, no matter what it says, and I want to give your audience a sense that there will be lots of talks about ideologies and thoughts and new ways of thinking about things, but what is the reality, right? What is the grounded micro reality? I'd say it's still a very, very pragmatic one. It's a very practical one. So how can China really, if it's a purely socialist economy, have also one of the most dynamic social entrepreneur kind of landscape in the world today? And therefore, I don't think that these labels are black and white are as useful. But China has fostered a kind of collective goal and market mechanisms to be a means to deliver some of the goals. But I would also say that it is certainly trying to find an answer. It has not found a better answer than the West in answering to the inequality issues, to the climate issues, injustice issues, the communal issues. But it is trying to find an alternative path.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump into one of the topics that has come up and in our conversation, but also generally, and that is this notion of decoupling. And I think I have a sense of where you might go with this, but maybe I should let you say where you think this can or should be going. When you hear talk of decoupling, we've heard it over the years from China and certainly from the United States, and the wider world has a view on it. And your view, is this realistic, dangerous, or what should we be thinking about this?
Well, today I turned up the news and I saw the Secretary of the Treasury, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, say something like, U.S. and China do not want to decouple. Great. That sounds great, because that really should have been the case all along. And let me tell you about the China side. No matter what they're saying outside and let me tell you about the China side. No matter what they're saying, you know, and outwardly, internally, you're not actually allowed to mention decouple. We cannot mention the word decouple on the social media or anywhere. So that has been kind of a concept that really shows you where China stands, right? China does not want to decouple from the U.S. China does not think that it is good for anybody, nor for the world. China believes that there are ways to manage the relationship, even if it is the most competitive two powers in the world today, even if they both have security needs to be satisfied. They believe that the relationship should be managed, and they do not want to take the decoupling route. There's a critical area in which there's inevitably a parallel system that will take place, and that is technology, critical technology. But what we have seen is that the tech autonomy, right, autonomous technology, especially in the choke points, if you will, for China, semiconductors, maybe thanks to the Biden export controls, have become much more domestically self-sufficient. We've certainly seen a massive acceleration after the controls started to take place, and more broadly speaking, the export controls have been effective starting from Trump 1.0. Really, it became an existential threat for China, which really relied critically on U.S. technologies in some of these so-called choke point areas, and that was an existential threat. But ever since, and we can see this with the show, the SemiCon show last year, that domestic capacity has significantly improved. Lots of gaps were filled. But more importantly, the point is that pivotal economies in the tech supply chain, like Japan and Korea, are no longer just siding with the US. They also want to have a foot in China because they want to hedge their bets, especially in light of what is happening now with the trade wars, with the greater uncertainty, with less reliability coming from the US administration, as well as seeing economic opportunities in the autonomous tech chain in China. And I'm not sure that's exactly what the US wanted to see by saying that we need to, you know, kind of stop some of the critical technologies progress. It certainly has inflicted short-term pain, but really in gearing up of the whole country in tackling these really difficult issues in the last few years, and there has been substantial progress. So I think in those areas where there it concerns national security, military capabilities, there will inevitably be a parallel system. But I do see that there will be some normality, or there should be some normality in mutually engaging with each other on the investment and trade front. And most importantly, still the flow of talent. Because from what I understand, the majority of OpenAI's research team consists of either Chinese nationals or Chinese Chinese heritage. From what I understand, a company like OpenAI, their research team have many people with Chinese heritage or Chinese nationality, even, and that goes to show that there needs to be continuous flow of knowledge and to do great things, including collaborations, not only in AI but in the biotech space, in medicine, in really important subjects where you have the top two countries with the leading minds and leading researchers should really be collaborating together, not to mention the global challenges that we are facing. And let's, you know, if we see another financial crisis around the corner, global financial crisis, I'm pretty sure that the two central bank governors are not going to be talking about decoupling. They're going to be talking about how to work together.
Well, let's pivot from that to some of the perceptions that a lot of Americans, but others around the world have had about the role of the World Trade Organization and China's role in the World Trade Organization. I'm sure that you are very familiar with a lot of the commentary among economists, but also non-economists about concerns, and they inform the current negotiations that are underway, but are larger than just the current negotiations underway, about issues that are non-tariff barriers, subsidization. There are consequences in terms of the state market hybrid approach in China to interacting with a world that thought it was launching on this experiment through the World Trade Organization that looked at liberalization and lowering tariff rates. But there's a lot of non-tariff factors that have come to the fore. From your book or your experience, help us understand your perspective on, again, not necessarily what to think, but how people should think about this kind of a challenge.
Well, first of all, I like to say that China does have a major challenge and something has to change. What we're seeing, just talking about observations, China is too dominant in manufacturing. China is too dominant in the renewable new technology, emerging technologies. The green transition is critically important. And whilst I think that the low-cost, high-quality Chinese green technologies could be beneficial for the green transition, I do also think that these technologies should not be dominated only by Chinese companies. And the challenge is not going to be just with the US going forward. It's actually going to be with everybody around the world if China continues to export that much capacity and to dominate in so many things. Now, that said, I want to give you my perspective on how to think about this, right? I do think that there are potential ways to resolve this. To give you an example, maybe China needs to appreciate their exchange rate, although there are technical difficulties as well there. Then it wouldn't be market-based determinant of exchange rate. But a 30% appreciation might resolve some of the trade tensions and the gaps. It could also think about potential voluntary export restraints in certain areas. Of course, the answer to this would be boost your domestic demand and domestic consumption, you can absorb more of that. These are things that I think that China should be actively thinking about and discussing with the rest of the multilateral institutions like the WTO and many others on finding balance. What we're lacking in the world today is some kind of harmony and balance, right? It's not necessarily the imbalance, it's not just the trade deficits. I think that's a misconception, but there is some kind of imbalance of productivity, of, you know, what kind of things are exported, who dominates and so forth. So there has to be more harmony. That said, if we look more at a more nuanced way at the data, 90% of the exports are done by private companies, many of which are actually of related to foreign multinationals. The latest research, which I have looked at, shows that the majority, again, 90, 95% of manufacturing investment patterns adhere with market moves. In other words, there's no overinvestment subsidized by the government. It's primarily market driven. The remaining that does not subscribe to that patterns are in some of the EV space and the renewables. And I think that could be really a focal part. But to think that the vast majority of Chinese manufacturing is successful and dominant because of subsidies, I think is a misunderstanding. First of all, the level of competition in China is just so fierce, and they are going after each other in terms of price wars. So that has led to really a deflationary pressure, but also in terms of supply chain efficiency, the cost base, the drive behind innovation to reduce costs. That is China's advantage. I mean, if you look at a company like Shein, they're able to produce these beautiful dresses for a pittance, right? So little that, why is that? It's not because of government subsidy. They don't have any government subsidy. It's a clothing company. But it's that mastering of the supply chain efficiency and the scale, the learning, the fast iteration, and the competitiveness. So even as the EVs, you're phasing out the subsidies now, we're going to see, right? You've taken out the subsidies of the solar panels already. They are not the drivers of China's market share into the future. But Chinese competitiveness is the result of many, many different factors. Again, if not because of government subsidies, there are a range of other factors which you might consider fair or unfair. But whatever the reason behind this, I still think that it is a problem for China, right? Mm-hmm. Dominate in so many sectors. So I like your audience to have a slightly different view. Look at the numbers, right? The government is super fiscally constrained at the moment. The local government's debt is incredibly high. They have to resolve all the local real estate social issues. They're not plowing it into companies, but the level of competitiveness, and this comes back to our previous conversation of the initial state push to have led to more competition. You can say whether it's right or not, but the end result is all the same. Mm-hmm.
Well, I've got a couple of things I want to try to at least touch upon before we sum up. One is a topic that we have had through many of our episodes, and it's kind of a core principle in how Americans think, but not just Americans think. And it's part of the dynamic in where the conversation has gone between the U.S. and China, but also the U.S. and other partners. That's the concept of reciprocity. And it's a very simple idea to express, a very complicated one to live. And I'd like to get your thoughts on when Americans say, well, do Chinese companies and individuals have in some ways more privileged access to America and opportunity with America than Americans do directly into China and opportunity in China. And so that might be a perception. But regardless of whether that perception is right or wrong, how would you see the role or concept of reciprocity fitting in U.S. and China interactions going forward?
If the U.S. wants to emphasize reciprocity, at least from the government level, the Chinese side emphasizes respect. And I think there's a lot of room that we can really have space to maneuver if two sides are willing to give each other what they want, which is respect and reciprocity. Now, I think that what you said about access to market was certainly true a few years ago. I'm not really sure it is the case now through all the stories and the examples that we've heard of U.S. China, Chinese companies really facing significant blocks trying to expand into the U.S. economy. Actually, virtually impossible, even nothing to do with national security say, look, it's going to be too much of a battle in the U.S., including investments and so forth. So I think the situation has really turned around with the Chinese side openly saying we're all open for business. And the negative list of investments, what you can't invest, has reduced. And we've given, you know, wholly subsidized foreign ownership to companies like Tesla and American banks. And I actually argue that this is the right strategy. Open it up for all the American companies to come to China and to make money. Let's make money together. Let's make the pie together, I think is really the right approach to take advantage of the growth potential. So in terms of reciprocity, I really think that China can be pushed in the right ways, you know, to do things. Even the Chinese admit themselves that there's room to change things, to negotiate. You know, but again, it has to be on the basis of mutual respect. And that is something where a country of, you know, civilization of 1,000 years really truly I'll make my answers really short, so I don't have to cough so much. But this is founded upon China's demands of mutual respect, given the civilizational legacies of the country. And I think respect is, again, a cultural phenomenon. Again, how they talk, what do they talk about, how to approach it is really, you know, can really make for some change. And I'm not really sure that President Trump's approach right now, very aggressive, what Chinese think are bullying, is really the right strategy. But with the right strategy, I think you can definitely push China to change certain things to serve more reciprocity. And I think that given within the economic sphere, but things like Tesla, you know, by the way, Tesla's Chinese government gave Tesla a huge amount of subsidies to manufacturing its cars. I think they're actually very, very pragmatic. They like American companies. They like Americans to come into China, and reciprocity could be a right goal, but only under the right circumstances.
All right. Well, then we'll go to the final topic that I'm really interested in getting your take on, and that is the notion in your book about the current generation being a radical break from the past. What does it mean for there to be a radical break from the past in the context of the economics of our relationship, the U.S.-China or China in the world? But I don't want to put words in your mouth. What should people from the outside understand as a radical break? What are they breaking from? What are they moving to?
I think if you want to know China in the next 5 years, 10 years later, you really ought to understand about the new generation. And I think that if there's any hope of reducing U.S.-China tensions and leading to a more sustainable path, it will be the new generation who will steer that. And I say that in telling you how they are a radical break from the past, because they're radically different from the previous generation in so many ways. Maybe because they grew up in an era of more prosperity. They are also more confident. They also care a lot more beyond material life. They are the champions of social awareness, animal rights. They care about inequality. They care about the global environment, much like the Gen Zs around the world. And they're also highly innovative, but they're also very fluent with multiple cultures, many languages. So many students get sent abroad to study every year. But also what's relevant for the U.S.-China discussion is that they actually, all of this is really a cycle, right? Once you get to a certain cycle of level of prosperity, they think about other things. They don't think about lining up the manufacturing lines and working three shifts a night to earn that a few extra dollars as the Foxconn workers did. And some of that really pave the path for this manufacturing dominance. Actually, China has 25 million vacant jobs in manufacturing. There's high youth unemployment. They don't want to do these jobs. They want to have a good time, like the American young people. They borrow to spend. So China is no longer such a big saving country in that perspective. They spend twice as much on apparel, entertainment, traveling than the previous generations. That gives a lot of opportunities for the world when they're not so focused on just making stuff, but on first of all, on their local environment, on local services, on really having a better lifestyle. And I think that would reduce a lot of the tension on the production manufacturing front. But again, the baton is passed to other countries, you know, Vietnam, Bangladesh, lower cost countries that will take up a lot of these jobs if they're not completely replaced by robots. But most importantly, you know, I think they're a great bridge between China and the world as it is, the global landscape to America. They have soft power. If you look at the TikTok founders, even the Temu founders, Pinduoduo founder, looking at the films that they're making, they really are interested in a truly more global perspective. And they're less interested in just competing in the same space and driving down the prices, but they're thinking always about innovation, about how to do things better and how to solve problems in everyday life. So they have that cultural fluency, they have the soft power, and they have a greater, you know, eagerness to engage with the world.
Well, Kaiyu, you've given us a lot to think about and added a lot to our conversation. I want to thank you for that. But before we part, are there any last thoughts you wanted to share with the audience? And please tell them where to go to follow your work and commentary.
Well, thank you very much for this. I really enjoyed our conversation. I do hope your audience finds some insights to be useful in my book. And this, all of my writings can be found on kujin.com. And I write also op-eds for real-time developments and issues. And I am working on a few other projects and would be delighted to share with your audience sometime in the near future.
Most welcome. Well, to the audience, if you enjoyed today's China Desk conversation, please tell your friends and consider subscribing. And as always, visit chinadeskpodcast.com. Thank you for joining. A thank you to Kaiyu Jin for sharing her perspective. Until next time, I'm Steve Yates, your host here at the China Desk.
Thank you for listening to the China Desk podcast, presented by the Federal Newswire and hosted by Steve Yates. Check out the Federal Newswire's family of websites, as well as their social media streams.